Blog Talk Radio.
It's Monday night.
I've been in the game a long time. When a catcher catches the ball and it strikes three, you call the guy out.
And if it's Monday, it's the Legion.
I'm not going to sit here and rip umpires, but you saw what you saw, clearly saw what you saw. I just saw it for the 10th time. Write it and say something once in a while. Have the nerve to say something.
Detroit Sports Talk with Attitude.
Attitude on three! 1, 2, 3!
Attitude!
Coming up tonight, will Big Al guess whose birthday it is? Who are the jerks of the week? What will Eno rant about now? The answers coming up next. Two guys who know Detroit sports. The voice of reason, Greg Eno and Big Al Beaton.
Monday night, 7 p.m., August 13th, 2012. You're listening to The Knee Jerks, Detroit Sports Talk with Eno and Big Al. I'm Big Al, a.k.a. Al Beaton. You know me from such sites as WaynePonce.com, The Wayne Ponce Experience, and BlessYouBoys.com. Bless you, boys. Joining me every Monday night to kick around last week of sports is the man I call the voice of reason, Mr. Greg Eno of GregEno.com. Welcome back, Greg. How you doing?
I'm doing just fine. If it's Monday, it's the Knee-Jerks, and that means that it's time to chat sports with you for about an hour and a half or so. I'm looking forward to it. I am Greg Eno from GregEno.com. That's where you can read me every day of the week. You can also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/GregEno or at Greg Eno. Follow the Knee-Jerks on Twitter. The Knee-Jerks.info is the way to do that, or our handle is at the Knee-Jerks. Our Facebook fan page is facebook.com/TheKneeJerks, and our blog, which I haven't been updating as much as I should lately, is at thekneejerks.us. That's our blog, and that's where you can find out another place where you can find information about the show, our guests, and so on and so forth. Tonight, we do have a guest. We will be joined by one of our favorite guests, affectionately known as fourth or fifth jerk, depending on where he falls on the ranking. Sometimes it's Matt Hutter is in there, and Biggers. Mike Shoddy is in the mix there, and Mike is with us tonight from Bleacher Report, NFL National Lead Writer, recently promoted to NFL National Lead Writer for Bleacher Report. We're happy to have Mike Shoddy with us tonight, talking Lions for about half an hour, and then, of course, we're going to do whose birthday is it, we're going to do Jerk of the Week, all that stuff. Next week, no guests, so this will be Al and I, but we will have Adam Biggers from Yahoo Sports joining us. Actually, Adam's not with Yahoo Sports right now. He's freelancing. Adam will be with us next week for Adam Lance, because that will be the third Monday of the month. So that's what's shaking tonight and next week. And keep your eye out on all our social media sites to find out what's going on with the program. But before we get into anything and all the other stuff that Al's got planned for us tonight, it's time to do Whose Birthday Is It, Maestro.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to the president. Happy birthday.
Everybody knows how we play the game by now. Basically, what I do is I give Al a clue or two or three of an individual whose birthday it is today in the world of sports. This individual is very much alive, and we're going to deviate from the basketball team that we've been doing the last few weeks. This person made his name in the National Hockey League, Al. He was born today in 1949 in Flin Flon, Manitoba, mining town there in Manitoba. He played his entire career with one NHL team. He's a second-round draft pick in 1969, and might have been a first-round draft pick had there not been concerns over his medical condition, which he overcame during the course of his Hall of Fame career.
Considering you probably described about 95% of NHL players in the 1970s, maybe except for playing for Flin Flon, which knocks it down to maybe 50%. So I will pass and wait for question number two, and hopefully I'll do better.
Okay, I understand. It'll become more crystal clear to you as we move on, but that's good enough. We'll do that as a second clue after we speak with Mike Shoddy. Mike Shoddy is one of our favorite guests, of course. He's affectionately known as one of the jerks, the third, fourth, or fifth jerk, whatever you want to call him. He's been in the program many, many, many times. You can find out more about Mike on our blog at knee-jerks.us. And, of course, go to Bleacher Report, where he is the national NFL. National lead writer for Bleacher Report. Very pleased to announce that just happened recently. And Mike's here to talk about the Lions for the next half hour. So, Mike, thanks for being with us tonight. We appreciate it.
Always good to be with you guys.
Thank you so much. There's a lot to talk about. Actually, I was trying to get you on the program a couple weeks ago and kind of do a training camp preview. We'll get our schedules to mesh, but this might be a little bit better because now we've got at least one exhibition game under our belt. Talk about it. I think we kind of did this last year with you too after the first exhibition game. So this is kind of a turning into an annual thing. And we're going to just talk, Mike, in the next half hour about, you know, what you saw, what you've seen in training camp so far, what you saw in the football game on Friday night, what you might want to see or expect to see in the next few exhibition games, and of course leading into the regular season opener. That's what we'll do. And I guess the first question is, what fans probably want to know is, you know, I know that it's, you know, exhibition pro football is not the most engaging thing in the world, but you know the games are played and you do have to talk about them. That being said, is there anything, Mike, that you can take? When I say you personally and the fans, is there anything anybody can take from the first exhibition game, or is it just completely a total washout? Doesn't matter. Doesn't mean anything.
I mean, there are two very opposing camps. There's a camp that is so Texas football fan. So any football, they're just ready to not only watch and love and absorb, but then also completely, react to everything that's going on out there. And that's one extreme. And the other extreme, you've got guys out there, my good buddy at Bleacher Report, Aaron Nagler is one of them, all the guys over at Football Outsiders, will always sit there and remind us, it doesn't matter, just be giant.
Yeah.
And somewhere in the middle, there's the street and say, I'm going to watch this game, I'm going to enjoy it. And there are things I can do that I'm not going to overreact to, and I'm not going to pin my entire, you know, frame of reference around this one preseason game. There aren't so many to do. And for the Lions specifically, we thought it should be that. Basically, exactly like it was last year. There's not a lot has changed for the Detroit Lions in the last, you know, 6-7 months. This team was used to the playoffs last year. This team can make it back to the playoffs.
We're talking with Michael Shoddy, the NFL national lead writer for Bleacher Report here on the Knee Jerks. I'm GregEno.com. And Big Al, I'll be from Wayne Fox Experience. WayneFox.com, of course, is great with us as well. Okay, now the game is in the books. The Lions lost 19-17. Not that that really matters, of course, but they did lose late. Not that that matters either, necessarily. But, you know, there were a couple things that that stood out. One of them was, maybe a few things that stood out. Dwight Bell, running back, we'll talk about him in a second. Kellen Moore, we'll talk about his shaky debut at quarterback. We'll talk about the secondary, Bill Bentley. But just an overall impression, Mike, when you back at the game. Jim Schwartz probably was not very happy. He didn't feel like his team came out very prepared. As far as first exhibition games go, before we get into the specifics, what were your impressions?
Well, I think I'm going to line up with Jim Schwartz, frankly, because he could kick my butt, and I'd rather not disagree with him. But, you know, not only do I enjoy that he came out and said what he said about me, improve all three phases of the game. You can improve at every level on defense and on offense. But I'm glad he said it. I agree with it, and I'm glad that that is the stance he's taken. Because I think I've said to you guys plenty of times that I feel almost like the coaching staff has copied the start of the path. Where staff can go out and have a bad game and nothing is set. Or, you know, blaming the club. Same thing with Dawson too. You know, there's always been times where he could have played better, but it wasn't set by the coach. And Schwartz came out and basically said, Evolution was out there today, could have played a little better. And that's why we lost. That's why we didn't look as good as we should look. This is not the football team we want to put on the football team. And I think, while maybe that's a little harsh, I think it is true. I think everyone came out a little bit rusty. I mean, the Cleveland Browns came out more fired up, whether it was, they wanted to win more, you know, the meeting was better. But there's something about that they both the way they came out, that kind of looked like the Lions were backing into this game. We're almost on, like, neutral, and they got on the football field. You could just tell the Cleveland Browns were ready, you know, to show the Lions what's up. So you're the playoff team. We're going to take it right to you. And I think that's what Coach Lewis is reacting to. Not necessarily the talent level of the team should be better, but basically the way you prepare for a game should not change just because it's a
good team. You know, that is an interesting change because it leads me to ask you something that I didn't have prepared as far as my show notes go, but as you say that, I don't want to get too far into the regular season yet in terms of prognostications because we're still, you know, only one game in the preseason.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
What you said about the Browns maybe coming out and wanting to show the Lions that, you know, get ready to play with a little bit of a target on your back.
Yeah.
Playoff teams like in the NFL, of course, come and go. I mean, teams can go, can make it there, not make it there the next year. You know, it's very up and down kind of a thing. Only several, only a handful of teams are perennial playoff participants, it seems like, anymore. So there's a lot of these teams that are, will show up in the playoffs and then disappear for a couple of years and show up again and so on and so forth. This is the first year, obviously, the Lions will be going into any season as, you know, coming off of a playoff year in 12 years, essentially. So, looking ahead, it kind of, we're kind of going off this off the beaten path here. But
yeah, well, yeah,
knowing that, does that concern you at all? Is that something that you kind of look forward to seeing how the Lions react to coming off a season in which they made the playoffs and then where the expectations are so high?
I mean, we'll have to see what we get to this point if the team has the same attitude that it had in the playoffs. I don't think that's the case. I think being a home preseason opener, there just wasn't a lot to play for. And you kind of see it in Stafford's demeanor and the way that, you know, the defense walked around the field, and, you know, Stafford will let me. You know, there just wasn't as much fire. And I think when you get to the regular season, things are ramped up. There's more people there. You know, there's you're actually playing for something. And I think that if they do come out slow, you know, maybe if they lose a couple games or if they play poorly in the first couple of games, then you start worrying that this is a team that doesn't know how to deal with success. Because I said this to you guys before, too. This is a Lions team that, you know, had no idea how to deal with adversity under guys like Marinelli and all of the other coaches under Matt Millen. And they finally learned how to deal with adversity under Jim Schwartz. Now they have to learn to deal with success. They have to be able to come out with a better team and impose their will. And they did really get some problems. But again, the preseason, you know, obviously shifts your course off. But, you know, let's see if it happens in week two, preseason. Let's see if it happens in the regular season, week one. If that's the case, then yeah, this is a team that needs to figure out how to be good. And,
well, they probably have
to. Everything has to go through it. When you're ascending up the ranks, it doesn't matter how much talent you have. It's all about dealing with adversity and then dealing with success. And then halfway there, you just got to get together.
We're talking with Mike Schotte, NFL National Lead Writer for Bleacher Report here on the Knee Jerks. I'm Greg Unum from GregUnum.com. And Big Al Offbeaten from WingPots Experience, WingPots.com. And let's bring Big Al in. What you got for Mike Schotte?
Yeah, just to kind of follow up on Mike's saying about the team having to learn how to deal with adversity and essentially learn how to be a winning team. This is something we've brought up constantly on my other podcast, the Bless You Boys podcast, and we're talking about Justin Verlander, is that in 2011, Verlander got pretty much every break, everything went his way, and ended up winning the AL MVP and Cy Young and won 25 games. We kept telling our listenership that he could pitch just as well, if not better, which he has this year, and he's going to end up with a worse record, which is what's happening. I believe it's 12-7 this year. He's just not getting the breaks. Could you see the Lions, Mike, having the same issues, maybe taking a step back record-wise, even though they may end up being a more talented team? Because realistically, the Lions won 3 or 4 games last year that they should not have won. So considering those huge comebacks they had. So, do you see the Lions taking a step back record-wise this year and maybe missing the playoffs?
You know, to keep the analogy in football, not that I don't love Justin Verlander, but, you know, perception is everything. With Ndamukong Suh came out in his rookie season, he piled up, you know, a third sack number for a rookie defensive tackle. Everyone said, well, this, you know, this is the best. And then sophomore season came around, he did six sack numbers.
Yeah.
So everyone said, well, what happened?
I can also have him on in the shirt.
And he was basically a non-factor when he wasn't getting those sacks. And in
year
But still, basically a non-factor when he wasn't, you know, when it was 3rd and 20 and he was able to hit his third back and go after the quarterback. He played about the same, but the perception because of the staff and the national media who will watch the game but not necessarily watch every team, you know, their perception was that he had declined. And in reality, he probably got a little better. The numbers just didn't bear that out. There's only one guy who can get a sack on a play. And last year, that was Cliff Avery, and he got the big box because of that. So the Lions are set up in a way for failure because, like you said, there were games last year that they won because football found their way, because they got less risk at that time. I'm a firm believer in creating their own luck. I think it's still a very talented team. I think it's a team of playoff talent. But like, you know, like you said, you have to learn how to be good. You have to learn to be a winner. And if those lucky breaks don't happen, or if they don't come out and flat out destroy the team that they should be beating, you know, there could be another team very easily. Minnesota is a team that lost a bunch of games last year for the first one. I think they lost something like 7 or 8 games. So, or by one score. So, Minnesota's team that can get the Lions and run right down their throat with Adrian Peterson. There are other teams out there that should, you know, should
beat
the Lions, but very easily, you know, Matt Stafford throws an extra point. Whoever the running back happens to be drops the ball once or twice, you know. The margin there in the NFL is so thin that unless, like we've been saying, unless you know how to win, unless you know how to control those errors and how to impose your will on the other team, that margin of error becomes razor thin, so you can see through it, and when you see the other side, you know things are going to start going wrong. So this is a team that basically, again,
it's actually Saturday. I forgot to mention that.
Year. They have the exact same question marks, the exact same strengths and weaknesses.
No, the Gary Gooden do Friday this week. So they said, we can bring everybody in on Saturday instead.
Those question marks that they answered last year. And at the end of the year, against teams like the Packers and the Saints, you know, we're answered with a resounding vote.
We're talking Mike Schotte, NFL national lead writer for Bleacher Report here on the Knee Jerks. Continuing along with that, with what Al was saying, and he makes a good point, by the way, because there were a number of games, like he said, where you just, you're lucky if you win one, well, you're fortunate if you win one of those games, let alone, you know, I can think of the Dallas game, of course, the Minnesota game, both on the road. There was another big comeback, but they started poorly against Carolina. They came back and won that game at home. You know, there was just Tampa in the week one was a comeback victory. So, yeah, I mean, and then you mentioned the Vikings, Mike, and you're right. There's such a, you know, any given Sunday and any given football game, you pluck out of the schedule. It's amazing to me how just every game just can turn on one or two plays. That's how evenly match, I think, the talent level in the NFL really is. But, you know, there's a number of, you know, before we even get to the regular season, there's still a number of issues that Lions fans are concerned with and probably should be concerned with about this football team, and one of them is running back. Obviously, Jahmyr Best is situations up in the air. I'll ask you your take on that in a little while. But just overall, with Mikel LeSure being also a question mark, frankly, we don't really know what we have there. Joyke Bell came in, Keelan Williams both ran up the ball hard Friday night. Of course, you've got Kevin Smith. You know, so what there's a number of guys in there in that mix, but Mike, we're not in a running, it's not a running league anymore. So how much should the Lions really be concerned about the running situation? What do you, I mean, what is going to be resolved in that situation in the preseason?
I wrote an article, I think, 2 weeks ago now that basically called out the Lions critics, and I try not to write about the Lions too much as a national writer now, but it called out the Lions critics for, you know, asking these questions about the Lions that they didn't really ask last year, because no one expected the Lions to be a good team last year. No one asked, well, who's your running back if that's it, or who are your defensive backs? No one asked those questions. The Lions have not gotten worse. The Lions running that situation is better by far than it was last year. And the Lions got to the playoffs with, you know, absolutely zero at running back at times. And you don't ask these questions about the Patriots or about the Green Bay Packers. You know, when there's elite teams that have an elite passer like Matthew Stafford, you don't ask who your running back is because it doesn't matter. You could trot Artu Spinner out there again, and he would be fine for that team because, guess what, we're going to throw 50 times. Because why wouldn't you throw 50 times when you have Matt Stafford, Nate Burleson, Calvin Johnson, Titus Young, Brandon Pettigrew, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, this is a team that passes, or that runs to set up the pass, or passes to set up the pass, or passes to the tight end to set up the long pass, or whatever it is.
Oh, no
problem.
This is
a team that needs a dominant runner. Now, obviously, Jahvid Best completely changes the look on the football field. Stephen Logan's going to try that.
He wasn't allowed left field anyway. Just John never had a skinny nose.
Roster at that position.
He hasn't hardly any start.
Level of play, the same elite play that Jahvid Best can bring.
He's been eating meat and salad,
both running and passing.
And if we make corn, or you know, or
don't know what we're going to get out of him. I think.
But he hasn't been eating potatoes or noodles or.
The Mikel Ashore that we drafted out of the
Oh, line. Alec has been doing it, too.
And Kevin Smith,
Matt might be.
Who is that pass blocker Matt, on the
no.
running back table. He's you know,
no.
basically what we have right now, the one lead rusher. He's going to be good, but not great. But he's not, you know, Ben Jarvis.
Yeah.
I mean, Alex, the Patriots have that.
It may, might be.
He's not.
The only person that's the Alec, he's
the guy who will be able to run
sandwich
or get yards. But he's not going to rack up,
it.
You know, good carries the game. So, there is a question. You know, when they have to run, will they be able to run? That's the question. You know, at the end of games, are teams going to be able to come back because the Lions can't, you know, run out the clock? That's the question mark. The question is not, can they run the football? Because the answer to that question is, well, we don't want to. You know, the Lions themselves aren't answering that question. And Martin Mayhew isn't answering that question. Martin Mayhew is looking over at Jimmy Schwartz and Scott Linehan and saying, do we have to run the football? Really, do we have to? Because have you seen our passing weapons? And so it doesn't bother me if the Lions don't have a dominant runner. But quite frankly, you know, if there's one thing to take away from the first preseason game, is that they looked okay running the ball. And I'm talking the starters and I'm talking the backups. All looked good running the ball. And whether that's a focus this year or whether that's just a symptom of Bill Taylor being out for the Cleveland Browns, so they don't have as much run stuffing ability. Whatever it is, I know it's the preseason, I know it's the Cleveland Browns, but it at least looked like there was a commitment to trying to run the ball. And I still think they're going to come out throwing when it gets to the regular season, but if they can run the ball at all like they did for most of the first week of preseason, I think it's going to be a pretty solid season for that phase of the game.
We're talking with Mike Schottie, NFL national lead writer for Bleacher Report. You're listening to the Knee Jerks. I'm Greg Ingram from GregEngram.com, and Big Al, Al Beaton from the Wayne Fox Experience, WayneFox.com, of course, is here as well. Along those lines of running the football, of course, it all begins in the trenches and on the offensive line, and obviously the Lions' first-round draft pick, Riley Reiff from Iowa, drafted as a tackle, but there could be you could see playing time at guard as well. You know, we'll see how that plays out. But do you see him, Mike, pushing anybody for a starting job in 2012, or is his time probably going to be 2013 and beyond when it comes to starting? Or do you think that he could possibly be in that role, or at least pushing people for that role throughout the course of the season?
I think he's pushing both tackles right now. I don't necessarily think that he's going to start this year. I think I said you know, right when I talked to you guys after he was drafted, I think I, you know, said that 2013 was going to be his year to shine. But, you know, he's going to make it difficult. It is, you know, Gosser Chairless has been a make or break year for the Lions, and he needs to make it, or otherwise he'll just get cut because he's getting a lot of money, and they're not going to pay him that money to sit on the bench. And so Riley Reiff is going to make it difficult on Gosser. He's going to make it difficult on Jeff Backus as well. And so is Corey Hilliard. You know, I don't want to talk too much about Corey Hilliard, but he's having a fine preseason as well. And so Jeff Backus is going to play. You know, there's too much in that position than just who's better in any given moment. You know, Riley Reiff could come out and completely dominate all of the preseason, and they still start Jeff Backus because you want a veteran. You want a guy who has been in the trenches before. You want a guy who, you know, may get beaten like a ragdoll by Julius Peppers, but he at least knows what Peppers is doing because he's faced him enough times in the past. You know, so Backus has that position locked down. I think the way that Reiff starts this year, or that plays heavily this year, is going to be, A, if someone gets injured, Riley Reiff's just the first guy off the bench. I don't care if that's, you know, guard or tackle. You know, Riley Reiff is probably just going to be the first guy to play wherever there's. But also, there's going to be a rotation, because you're going to say eventually, we need to get Riley Reiff into the game a little bit. So whether it's, you know, whatever kind of analogy you want to make, whether it's the defensive second baseman in baseball or it's the, you know, third down back in football, you're trying to get Reiff up the field. Maybe it's on passing downs that you think his athleticism is going to, you know, be better than Jeff Max, or whether it's in, you know, run heavy downs and you slide him as a, you know, as a quote unquote tight end in certain packages just to help the run game. Whatever it is, you want Reiff on the field because you want him coming into 2013 a little more seasoned than he is right now. So I think he's going to see the field a lot. I think as the season wears on and as injuries start piling up, guys start to get dinged up, you're going to want Reiff out there. And I think that's true for a lot of guys. I think Jacob Fox has started to earn some more snaps. I think Corey Hilliard, again, has played great. I think there's going to be guys this year. The offensive line is still a bit of a mess, but I think because of the depth, you're not going to notice it as much. It's not going to be as paper thin as it's been in the past.
Yeah, that's depth is everything in the NFL, and that's definitely something the Lions, until recent years, have absolutely not enjoyed, but I think they're beginning to enjoy some in certain positions under the Jim Schwartz / Martin Mayhew era, if you will. Let's bring Big Al back in, Al.
Yeah, you know what's kind of a good analogy to that is the New England Patriots. For years, had this solid offensive line, and everyone always said, you know, oh, it's because, you know, Matt White is just so good. Matt White was really good, but they used a very heavy rotation up in New England, and a lot of those backups got tons of playing time. And Matt White never had to go out and play every snap. And so now Matt White's gone, and it isn't that Nate Solder stinks. It's just that Nate Solder's on people a lot. And
right.
He did not look good the first season, you know, the first game of the preseason. And so I think that's the thing right now. They're starting to build up that depth. And, you know, Jeff Backus may get beaten like a ragdoll again this year. You know, he still might give up, you know, really hard sacks, and Stafford might go down to the turf a lot. But he won't be on the field as much. So when he comes out, he's a little bit fresher. And we're not going to notice him as much. And hopefully that's the case across the offensive line, that it's not one guy out there for, you know, 50 snaps a game where he just, by the end of the game, so ragged that someone gets, you know, the best of him. So I think that's, they're not the Patriots yet, and they're not the Patriots offensive line of their Super Bowl year, but this is a team that's not building talent as much as building depth, and depth is a very important thing.
That is very important, and that's a good point about, you know, guys not being fresh. And we talk a lot about it on the defensive line, but you're right. It's, you know, it can also apply to the offensive line as well. Al, what you got for Mike Schottie?
Well, we got to talk a little bit about the injuries and the latest that have cropped up. And this also relates to the depth he was just talking about is Louis Delmas is out with an unspecified knee injury. Obviously, though, they're calling him week to week, which sounds like it's more major than minor. Plus, Amari Spivey is suffering from headaches and wasn't able to play in the first preseason game. And there's fears that that may relate to the concussion he suffered last year, which may keep him out for some quite a bit of time, let alone we all know what happened with the cornerbacks and the and cutting Barry and so on and so forth. So the secondary looks like it's in really, really rough shape right now. And without their quarterback, Louis Delmas, I got to be honest with you, Mike, I'm concerned. So should the Lions be preparing to have really a bare-bones secondary, especially if Louis Delmas is seriously hurt?
Yeah, you could have those guys healthy, and you still have what many in the league would consider a bare-bones secondary. But again, this goes back to, you know, the questions that critics want the Lions to answer that the Lions don't care answering. You know, this is a team that was very bad in the secondary last year, but for most of the season, got through.
Yeah.
You know, you really have to take out, you know, the playoff game, first of all, because that doesn't necessarily count for stats. But if you take out the Green Bay Packers game, which is just a very much an aberration, this is a defensive backfield that was horrible. They weren't good, but they were below average, not worse than the league. And so you don't have teams like the Green Bay Packers or the New England Patriots, who were worse at pass defense than the Lions. You know, you didn't ask them on their way to the Super Bowl, you know, hey, how are you going to stop the pass? So this didn't matter. You had Aaron Rodgers and you had Tom Brady. It doesn't matter who's scoring against you because you're going to outscore them. And that's, I don't want to say that's the Lions' philosophy, because I think Jim Schwartz, again, would get very angry at that. But to some extent, you have to spend money in certain places in the salary cap era. And defensive backfield is a spot the Detroit Lions said we're going quantity over quality. So we did things like draft Jonte Green and, you know, Bill Bentley in the third round that he turned up great. We're going for depth. We're not going for going out and paying a guy like Nnamdi Asamoah $13 million a season, because that's not where we want to build. We're building along the defensive line. We're trying to strengthen our linebacking core. We're trying to build our offense into a superpower. That's the way that championship teams around the league have been built, and the Lions are trying to execute that. The New York Giants won the Super Bowl last year with literally the worst defense in the league and zero running game. And, you know, they improved both areas coming into this season, but no one asked them, well, you know, how dare you get to the Super Bowl not being able to defend the pass? Because they were able to get out after the pass or when it happened. And so that's really where the Lions coaching staff needs to spend their time. Yes, you need to get through the secondary. You need to muddle through. Hopefully Louis Delmas comes back. But quite frankly, Louis Delmas, emotional leader though he may be, has made some pretty serious errors in the last few years. He's, you know, gotten to the point where he's gambling more than he's in position, and he's launching his body in a haphazard fashion rather than the hard-hitting, you know, form tackler we saw when he first came out of Weston. You know, so he could be better. So they could be better. But they're both better than Wendling, who you don't want starting on defense or even really playing that much on defense at all. He's essentially a special teams player. And so, and we heard Mark DeVay was also a cornerback that this season. He's example, you know, during the preseason. This is a team that needs to get healthy, that needs to get, you know, rebuild their depth again. You know, you can be bad in a defensive secondary if you have to, because that will cover over a multitude of your sins. But, you know, I'm not worried right now because it's still the preseason. If he's week to week, he can be out for the next 4 weeks, and I don't think Delmas is at the point where the preseason is going to help him get better, you know, drastically so. But I think they need to get back sooner rather than later. I hope his concussion isn't, you know, up there with Javis Best. You know, he's a guy that needs to get back. I'm not really worried, however, because I think there is still some young talent on this team that I think needs the snaps more. And we've talked so much about, you know, at the quarterback position, you need lots of reps. And so one of the worst parts of a quarterback battle is, well, you're taking reps from your eventual starter because you're splitting them 50-50, whereas when you have a starter, you're splitting them like 80-20. So in the defensive backfield, it's the same way. You only have so many reps. And so Dalmas and Slavey really need the reps? Well, they could use them, but I think there's guys out there like Greenwood, like Green, like Bentley, that could use them more. And I think Bentley's a perfect example of a guy who wasn't necessarily getting the reps when he first got here, but all of a sudden some injuries happened, he started getting more and more reps, and, you know, I think we'll be able to do with Bentley and Alfonso Smith. That's good. It's not your strength of your team. But I think it's a unit that can muddle through if the front seven does their job.
couple things I want to hit you with, Mike, before we let you go. One of them is Ndamukong Suh. He said he's a little bit more mature. He learned some things last year. You talked about him earlier in the discussion about drawing the comparison to he and Justin Verlander in terms of maybe seemingly taking a step back, but maybe not so much. How pivotal, in your mind, is this year for him, both in terms of his career and the Lions' fortunes?
You know, honestly, I'm at the point right now with Sue that I don't care how he plays as long as, A, he gets a driver and never gets behind the wheel of a car ever again, and B, consistent with motion. Because this is a guy that, when he's taking play out on offensive guards in the good way, he can be as dominant as he wants to be. We know he's a phenomenal athlete. We know he hits with a ton of bricks. We know he, you know, knows the position. He's just an athlete out there. But he's a guy that when he gets over anxious, when he gets over, you know, when he hopes up, this is a guy who can be completely driven out of a play by a smarter player. He just needs to play smarter. Keep his emotions in check. And the rest will take care of himself. We need to play better this year. Whatever. I don't care. He needs to play smart. He needs to, on and off the field, be a professional athlete. Not just a great athlete, a professional athlete. And that's something we haven't seen out of him, too. We've seen him, you know, give loads of money to Nebraska and to other charitable exploits. We've seen him be a great pitch man for Subway. That's making money, but he hasn't been professional while doing it. He hasn't been professionally, showing himself on the football field and off the football field. Once he takes that next step, then I'll be worried about how he improves as a player. Until then, he's just going to be, you know, a rookie to me because he hasn't gotten to that point where he's learned how to be a professional.
Wow, some strong words from Mike Shoddy. Before I let you go, I want you to comment on two things real quick. Number one, over and under on Jabba Best's career continuing. Or will it be, is it over? And secondly, Kellen Moore, does he make the team, does he not make the team go?
I think that Jabba's best career is not over, but I think that we're going to see maybe a Kevin Smith-like exit from the game, where maybe when Jabba's best plays again, you know, maybe he'll play a little bit for the Lions this season, but I think he needs to sit out. Maybe he comes back to the Lions, maybe he's just on IR for an extended period of time, but this is a guy that needs to be away from the game. He needs to have time where he's not worried about football and where he's worried about his health. As for Kellen Moore, man, I hope not. This is a guy who physically is topped out. He's not getting any better. And he didn't show anything in that preseason game. Yes, it's just preseason. But he didn't show anything that makes him worthy of an NFL roster. He's not going to get any smarter. He's already really smart. He's not going to learn the playbook any better because they've already said he's doing phenomenal. He's topped out as a prospect. I don't think RJ Arch is going to get the spot either, but I'd like to see the Lions try to sneak one of them through on waivers. Whoever gets through on waivers and the practice spot, in goodness gracious, when you've got Sean Hill and Matt Stafford, you don't need a third quarterback unless they're both injured. And in that case, your season's over.
Okay, well, we definitely all are.
I am not a Kellen Moore fan. I hope that is clear.
Well, he surely didn't do anything Friday night to change your mind, that's for darn sure. We've been talking with Mike Shoddy, NFL National Lead Writer for Bleacher Report. That's where you can find him. Go to bleacherreport.com and search Mike Shoddy, S-C-H-O-T-T-E-Y. And, of course, he's on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle on Twitter again? I forgot.
Same exact thing, Shoddy, S-C-H-O-T-T-E-Y.
That's right, just Shoddy. Okay, Shoddy on Twitter. He's always welcome on the E-Jerks, and I'm sure we'll have him a couple times during the course of NFL season talking Lions. Thanks, Mike, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys. Good night.
Good night. Okay, Mike Shoddy from Bleacher Report, always happy to have him. And I'm ready to do clue number two of whose birthday is it?
Fire away.
Okay. First clue, I was born in 1949 in Flin Flon, Manitoba. I was a second-round pick in 1969 by the team, the only team that I would ever play for in the NHL. I had diabetes, which dissuaded several teams from drafting me. The Detroit Red Wings, actually, I found out, Al, were one of the teams that almost traded to get this guy away from the team that drafted him. And boy, were the Red Wings' fortunes have changed in the 70s had that trade gone through. But he played his entire career with one team. I was a three-time MVP winner, the Hart Trophy winner of the NHL. And I was an eight-time All-Star. And twice I led the NHL in assists.
You know, the more I thought about it, and it was the diabetes that gave it away, in that it's, he's probably one of the most known players to ever have it. And plus, he was known as probably one of the, agitator ever, you know, and famously broke an ankle of one of the Russians in their big Canadian-Russian series, when, like, what, 72 or something like that. I think you're talking about Bobby Clark.
I'm talking about Bobby Clark. I sure am Bobby Clark. I did not know that Bobby Clark won three Hart trophies. I don't know if you did.
I didn't realize that either. You're right.
1973, 75, and 76. Of course, in 74 and 75, he captained the Flyers. There were only two Stanley Cups to date. He was also general manager of the Flyers on two different occasions, and also, and I forgot about this, he was general manager for the Minnesota North Stars for a couple of seasons, including that year in 1991 when they surprisingly went to the finals against Pittsburgh. Hall of Famer in 1987, was a rookie, was an All-Star as a rookie, I should say. Also GM Florida for 1 year, was a GM of Florida for 1 year before he went back to the Flyers. Was the GM of the Flyers when the Red Wings beat them in 1997 in the finals, and made a number of coaching changes after that, and was criticized for not making it out of the first round like 4 or 5 years in a row, and had a very famous tiff with Eric Lindros. But yeah, Bobby Clark, 63 years old today. Happy birthday to Bobby. And I did not, like I said, I didn't know this until I looked him up, that after he was drafted, the Red Wings and the, I believe it was the Canadiens, both made serious efforts to trade for him, get him away from Philadelphia before he even played an NHL game. And the Flyers said, no, we know what we got with this kid. We are not letting him go. And if the Red Wings had gotten Bobby Clark, who knows what would have happened in the 70s. But anyway, that's whose birthday is this week, today on the 13th, and come back next week, Al, and play again. I hope you will. we've got a lot to talk about, and that's not all good. I mean, the Tigers are a little wobbly. We'll talk about them. I'm sure we'll talk about Lions, maybe a little bit of Olympics. I'm not sure. You got a lot of stuff I know on your plate there. So let's get right to it.
Yeah. So obviously, the Tigers had not the best of road trips. Unfortunately, they lost the last two games in Texas. They're headed to Minnesota. Hopefully that's the place where they get well, because ever since the Horror Dome was torn down, the Tigers seem to have played very well there. And they really could use it, because the White Sox are two games ahead in first place. The A's have been no favors. So, like I said, though, if you want to win a division, you got to win games. Interestingly, Miguel Cabrera has put himself in the middle of the MVP race in the American League. Essentially, it's become a two-man race between Mike Trout and Miguel Cabrera. And I love what Jim Leland calls Mike Trout, Wonder Boy. But it fits. It's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this past week, people had an absolute fit when Justin Verlander threw 132 pitches in a game in a win. You wrote about the second guessing of Jim Leland has really become a sport as of late. And much of that is because of the bullpen, which is broken, really, in that Joaquin Benoit and Phil Koch have been throwing batting practice since the second half started. And actually, after Sunday's game, it turned out that Brian Villarreal admitted it. Now he has a bad arm. He told the Tigers, this wasn't in the show notes, this is something that just came out after Sunday's game, was Villarreal has said that he has his elbow feels tired. That's never a good sign. So he's going to be examined on Monday. Well, actually, and when you hear this, he will already be examined. Maybe we'll hear something. And obviously the corner outfielder roulette, which calls for more second guessing of Leland, with the juggling of the outfielders. Well, we'll talk all about that. We might touch a little bit on the Lions. We covered quite a bit with Mike, but we might go in a little bit about our thoughts on what we've seen, what we know. And the Olympics are a really hot topic. They came to an end Sunday night. Tape delayed in the U.S. as the closing ceremonies took place about 4 p.m. Eastern time Sunday, NBC finally got around to showing it about 8:15-ish our time, after having an hour and a half pregame show. So, medal count, America won the medal count, and kind of brought me back to the days where it seemed like it was always us versus them, the Cold War, which a lot of our listeners probably don't even remember. And Usain Bolt is most people consider him the greatest of all time, and Usain Bolt made sure to remind everybody about it, to say the very least. So we'll try and get to all this. We'll start with the Tigers. So it was a rough weekend, Greg. Tigers lost a heartbreaker Saturday night, walk-off win for the Rangers. Bullpen, it kind of didn't do so high. Essentially, Villarreal. Villarreal had an okay eighth inning, walked two guys to start tonight, kind of fell apart from there. Phil Koch allowed the winning run, inherited the winning run to score. Sunday, Wu Darvish pretty much just, I wouldn't say dominated. The Tigers did get guys in base, but they couldn't get the big hit. And more bullpen shenanigans from Villarreal, so, which kind of put the game out of reach for Tigers from them getting them back. So, Greg, I think it was a very telling comment from Jim Leland. This kind of goes into the second guessing of him. Last night, when he was asked about his bullpen, I should say Saturday night, when he was asked about how he used the bullpen, and that he went with Villarreal and Cope. And it was very telling when Jim Leland said, "Well, who do you want me to use?" Essentially saying, most of the guys I'm throwing out there right now aren't doing the job. I'm kind of grasping at straws here trying to find something. So are you concerned what you're seeing from the bullpen around? Because it looks like, I have a feeling this guy's hurt. We've kind of speculated on this on Bless You Boys that we think Joaquin Benoit is injured. Turns out Brian Villarreal is hurt. Jose Valverde hasn't been healthy all year. He's had back issues. You got to wonder if something's a full coke the way he's being hit, Greg. So for all the second guessing of Jim Leland, I can't really put much of this on his shoulders, because he's either got guys who are underperforming or he's got injured pitchers. So I really don't know how people can really complain about what Jim Leland does, but they are.
If you're going to second guess anybody, you might want to second guess Dave Dombrowski, because, I know this is going to sound like, I'm putting my hindsight glasses on, but really, I do a thing called Monday Morning Manager on GregEno.com. One of the things I do is I pick out a player every week, and I put him what I call under the microscope, and I say the reason that he's under the microscope for this week is he's a player that the fans should keep an eye on, or just kind of see how he is handled and how he responds to certain things based on the situation he's in at the time. And several weeks ago, I put Brian Villarreal, when he was going well, I put him under the microscope. I said, this is just kind of an under the microscope for the whole second half of the season, I said. Because remember what happened with Al Albuquerque last year? He was the same kind of a thing where he was lights out, then he fell into some injury problems. Some of it wasn't really his fault. It just happened. I said, now watch out. I'm hoping it doesn't happen with Brian Villarreal, but here's another guy who's been lights out, and he's kind of come out of nowhere, just like Albuquerque did last year. And now let's just see if he can, keep it up for the whole second half. I said, because that's going to be a big thing for the Tigers. Well, unfortunately, I am proven now to be clairvoyant, because that's exactly what's happening. He's going sideways. He has three bad outings in a row, essentially, including today. Sunday. Taping this on Sunday, and now the word, like you said, comes out that he is not all there physically with the elbow, which is definitely not good. But the reason why I say, Al, you can second guess Dave Dombrowski is, and of course, this bullpen is. I mean, you said broken. There's just no question. This bullpen is all of a sudden a mess.
Yeah, it looked fine a month ago.
Right. In a way, you can't blame Dombrowski, because when the trade deadline was coming, the bullpen was pretty much in order. But the reason why I think you can kind of allow, although Benoit was still starting to show signs of giving up a lot of home runs and stuff, I think where you can kind of play Monday morning armchair quarterback here is those acquisitions, those bullpen arms, Al, that you can acquire in the second half of the year, even after the non-waiver deadline is passed. See, these guys who you know pass their waivers and make trades for them interleague anyway. Those kinds of moves, they're not the sexiest moves in the world. They're not the big splashes maybe you make on July 30th or July 31st. But these are deals that you make that are kind of under the radar, and initially they may look like they're just depth moves, just moves to have more depth. But really, those to pick up some veteran bullpen arms, I've seen, I don't know how many times, World Series bomb teams do that. They pick up these veteran, sometimes these guys, are, you know, nobody's really been heard of, but they've been around the league for a long time, and they come in and they provide stability, they provide veteran experience, they provide another, just a sense of calm, because they've been through the wars. And all of a sudden now, you look at the Tigers' bullpen, and, you know, it is a mess. I mean, when you get to the point where Benoit is now not reliable, and Valverde is maybe less than reliable, although, the numbers would say that he's doing okay, then you throw the Phil Koch situation, which is puzzling and troubling. You throw in the Villarreal thing, which is, you know, troubling, but also not necessarily all that surprising. Now, like Jim Leland says, what do you want me to use? I mean, there's nobody else out there. Dwayne Bello is a long relief guy. He's somebody that you don't want to see in the game. Usually, if Dwayne Bello's in the game, the starter has been shelled. That's really when he comes in. He comes in the third or fourth inning. And so when he's in the game, that's never a good thing, usually. Although he does well, it's just that you don't want to see him in there. And the other guys, you know, Botero really, Al, is the only reliable reliever that, and guess what? He's a veteran. You know, it's funny how that works out. You know, it's almost to the point now where you want to just, like, use Dotel in either the save situation or the setup situation instead of, you know, assigning him that seventh-inning role, stubbornly assigning that seventh-inning role, whereas maybe, you know, he needs to be somewhere else. You can't have a guy, Al, like Benoit, serving up home runs at this alarming rate, 10 in those last 15 innings.
Yeah, that
you can't.
Really,
I mean, that's
scary.
It's very scary. You cannot do that. You just can't. That's just going to cost you way too many ball games. It's already cost. I can name off the top of my head half a dozen games what that's cost the Tigers. You just can't. We're down. This is not me anymore. We're down to the last 45 to 50 games of the year. These games obviously increase in importance. And when you're trying to chase a team and you're doing what Benoit is doing, which is essentially lost the game to the Yankees. He lost the game second game after the All-Star break to the Orioles, and a couple other occasions when he's given up. And he almost lost the game against Cleveland last week when he gave up back-to-back home runs. Fortunately, the Tigers mounted a miraculous comeback to salvage that game. But this can't go on. So I don't know maybe Dave Dombrowski has to go back to the phones and try to scour up another arm, another veteran arm for the bullpen, somebody who's not a household name, just to provide some sort of stability and give Jim Leland somebody else to go to. Because now it's to the point now where anybody he puts in there, you really don't have any other than Botel, you really don't have any confidence in.
Right, yeah. At this point, I'm getting to wonder, Greg, is that maybe they may end up having to take a flyer and bring up Bruce Rondon, the youngster who was who really impressed in the Futures game. He didn't pitch much in that game, but every pitch he threw was over 100 miles an hour. Unfortunately, he got suspended today after throwing at Will Grimes last night and starting a brawl. But, because Will Grimes is the ex-Tigers back in the minor leagues, but I have a feeling they're going to have to maybe start up that trolley from Toledo, because right now I have a feeling a couple of these guys are going to end up on a disabled list. I have a feeling Villarreal is going to head there. Even if they don't find anything structurally wrong, this is a young guy I think they do think a lot of, and if there's something with his arm, they may be best served just to sit him for a while. And you're right, Benoit, this is a guy who went from, he's been lights out since pretty much May of last year. You know, he had an early struggle when in his first month as a Tiger. But he wasn't that bad back then, we were all concerned. But this last month with Benoit, it's like, yeah,
he's throwing, literally throwing batting practice. So it's a huge concern. And you're right. There's a possibility Albuquerque could come back. I believe he's still in Lakeland working out right now, but there's no guarantees there. It really looks like it might end up being Rondon or bust, but it's definitely a huge concern. But I agree with Jim Leland. Like, what more do you expect him to do? There really isn't much he can do with this, with the lineup the way it is. And that also kind of leads up, Greg, to the outfield. Jim Leland has declared he's going to rotate corner outfielders. The only regular player in the outfield is going to be Austin Jackson, for very good reason. Jackson's having an MVP quality year. You know, at the very least, he's probably going to finish in the top 10 in the MVP voting this year. But in the corners, you got a bunch of guys who are either extremely streaky, unproven, or badly slumping, because he's going to try and rotate it, the DH and corner outfielder, between Quinton Berry, Brennan Bosch, Andy Dierks, Delmon Young, and Jeff Baker. And as we know, Quinton Berry, really kind of regressed to the guy what we thought he was going to be in the minor league. You know, come out of minor leagues, a fifth outfielder. Brennan Bosch may be the most frustrating ball player in the planet to watch, other than Delmon Young, because these are both guys who tend to swing at anything and have no patience at the plate, as we saw in Sunday's loss, where Bosch came up, runners in scoring position, had Darvish on the ropes, and swung at the first pitch. And that was the end. Right now, Greg, the only guys I feel very confident in the Tigers outfielders is Andy Dierks, who is unproven. The guy's hitting over 340, but he's never been this good before in his life. And then there's Jeff Baker, the infielder outfielder that he just acquired, who is a proven hitter against right-handed pitching. Obviously, that's all he can hit, though, because he's strictly a platoon player. So, you know, for all this juggling that Jim Leland says he wants to do, would you feel better, though, if they just went with an everyday outfield for what appears to be their most talented outfield? It's Andy Dierks, Austin Jackson, and Brennan Bosch, and then maybe platoon to DH with Young and Baker. I don't know about this juggling guys trying to get, like, Quinton Berry in there, because I think Quinton Berry is best served as a late-inning defensive replacement, pinch runner, pinch hitter type. So, and plus there is also the news that, obviously, that Delmon Young is no longer going to bat fifth against right-handed pitching. So, what do you think of Jim Leland's plan to try to squeeze six players into four positions?
Well, you know, we talked about this last week, and one of the things he said was that he's just trying to find somebody, a combination that maybe can get hot for a little while, mm-hmm. that can kind of make this dilemma kind of go away, at least if only temporarily.
Yeah.
I don't know, Al, why you wouldn't give more playing time to Andy Dierks, because, you know, he's clearly the best
big one right
hitter of that group. His batting average, obviously, speaks for itself, but also I think just in terms of his overall play discipline, his approach, the swing that he has, I just think he's the best looking player of those guys that you mentioned. And so I'm wondering, you know, why there's a little bit of reluctance on Jim's part to kind of put him in there every day. And he also puts him in different spots in the batting order a lot too, second, eighth, seventh. He doesn't seem to really know where Andy slots in. And Brennan Bosch, you mentioned it, he's extremely frustrated, as he's done with him. You talked about that inning yesterday, where the Prince Fielder and Miguel Cabrera had walked first and second. And two pitches, you Darvish, in two pitches, got three outs, essentially. And totally, and that was where the game was still kind of, in hand there. I mean, the Tigers were only down by three. They had an opportunity to really kind of tighten screws a little bit on the Rangers and Darvish. And I just don't see Andy Dierks doing what Delmon Young and Brennan Bosch did. I mean, I just don't see him doing that. And so I don't know why there's a reluctance to put Dierks in there when he's clearly, I think, the best hitter of the bunch.
Yeah.
But you know what? Here's what the problem is, though, Al. The problem is that is just kind of, the whole thing is just trying to find guys that are going to do the job. I mean, at this point, you're not going to get a lot of help outside the organization, certainly.
Oh, yeah.
You're not going to get
really, probably really any help from Toledo. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, come on. What's the realism of a guy from Toledo, whether it's from the pitching staff with his rundown, or whether it's a hitter? Nobody's going to come up here, Al, in this part of this time of the year, and be some sort of a Cinderella story. I mean, some sort of a story that's going to lead the Tigers and solve these problems. Jim Leland's got to work with what he has. And now, if Dave DeBrush goes out and grabs another arm for the bullpen, that's great. But we have to assume, you can't assume that. You have to assume that what you have is what you have. This corner outfield situation is almost every bit of a mess as the bullpen situation, because really, Andy Dierks is the Octavio Dotel,
yeah,
of that group. And then everybody else is the Joaquin Benoit, Jose Valverde, and Brian Villarreal. Because you don't know what you're going to get. Bosch and Young are maddening. Barry, like you said, is probably more suited to come in late in the game, provide defensive prowess, whatever you want to call it. But he's not going to be an offensive guy that's going to come in and
play Barry, the more he gets exposed.
Right. So you got to pick and choose your spots with him. You know, so it's just, you don't really know really what you got here, except for what you do have is maybe not enough. And it's a very troubling situation, because I don't know what really the answer is. I don't know that there really is one, except hoping that you run these guys out there and somebody's going to, you know, we talked about Dominion Young, for example, and you said, you know, I had said, well, maybe he'll, you know, he'll show flashes of last year, show flashes of why he threw up 100 runs a couple years ago. And then you said, well, I have a feeling we're not going to see that Dylan Young. And, you know, so far you're right. We have not seen that Dylan Young since we had that discussion. We've seen the very maddening ground into a double play, ground out to shortstop Dylan Young on the first pitch. Brendan Bosch is, I don't know what's up with him. I'm so aggravated with him that I'm willing to let the Tigers use him as trade bait over the winter to get somebody else, whether it's another position player or another
just
arm.
Just to cut in there about Bosch, this says it all about him. In today's post-game about Bosch, when asked about him, Jim Leland said, I don't know what to do with him. That was all these, I don't know what to do with him. That says volumes right there.
Yeah. Well, Jim Leland said that?
Jim Leland said that.
Yeah, that is very telling. It's very, very telling.
So, hey, let's talk a little bit more about something a little more pleasant. Let's talk about Justin Verlander. In his win over the Yankees, I believe it was Wednesday, he threw 132 pitches in what was really an easy win. It was a 7-2 victory over the Evil Empire. And after the game, mostly coming from the media, sports talk radio types, they started making noise saying Verlander shouldn't have been allowed to tie his career high in pitches in what was an easy win, and they may need him later in the year, and those extra 20 pitches could really hurt the Tigers down the line, blah, blah, blah. I found it interesting. Jim Leland's retort was, 120 pitches should be a piece of cake for any starting pitcher. And he also added that Justin Verlander could throw 140 easy, but the only way he would allow it is if he had a 10-year contract extension. So, personally, between you and me, Greg, I just find anybody starting to complain about Verlander's workload kind of a chicken little at this point. I think if there's one guy in baseball who has proven that he can handle a heavy workload, and that 120, 130 pitch game really isn't that big of a deal, it's Justin Verlander. I had never seen a pitcher ever who throws faster in the eighth inning than he does in the first inning. And this is like around pitch 130. He was throwing over 100 miles an hour at pitch 130 in this game. And he's done that before. And at this point, I think you would think people would realize that, yeah, I'm not going to do this with, say, Max Scherzer or Rick Porcello or Doug Fister. But this is Justin Verlander. He can handle the workload. This is essentially, we're saying, Verlander is a freak of nature at this point. The guy can handle the workload. He is a Nolan Ryan, Mickey Lolich type who can throw 270 innings in a year, and it's not going to seem to bother him one bit. And and this is why where it really comes to me is that there's no way Verlander was going to come out of the game anyway. He had that look in his eye, like, you know, if you take me out of this game, I'm going to take my glove and beat you over the head with it so you bleed. So, what was your take on this Verlander throwing, this was his second 130-pitch game of the year. Did it bother you at all, or do you think this is, again, much ado about nothing?
Well, you know, the folks that were concerned about it were, I think one of the reasons why they were concerned was the Tigers had a decent-sized lead at the time. It wasn't like it was a one- or two-run game. And you know, so I can see that concern. It's like, well, why is there a need to keep him out there when the lead is where it's at? But the other thing, too, Al, is that, you know, the way the bullpen has been so pockmarked lately, you wonder if a Verlander who's been out there for 120 pitches isn't still better than anything you've got down in the bullpen.
I don't think that's the question. I think that's bad. You're right.
Well, you're right. So there's that. I think that, you know, the postseason that he had last year was, you know, certainly affected by the weather. You know, I don't know that he was worn down, per se, by the time October came around. I really don't. I think that he just ran into some bad weather, and he ran into, a Texas Rangers team that was just phenomenal, although he did okay. But I think he's just, you're right. I think he is one guy that you don't necessarily, you mentioned Lowitz. I mean, some of these guys, you're right, they had rubber arms. Jack Morris, I never heard any complaints from anybody about Jack Morris pitching too many innings or throwing too much or whatever. He went out there and pitched 10 innings in a World Series game, for goodness sake, game 7 no less. You know, so, I mean, this is one of those things where you just kind of have to, I think, weigh your options. You know, am I better off with Justin Verlander after 120 pitches, or with a bullpen that not only maybe not is not airtight, but also people talk a lot about, you know, conserving energy with the starters, but you also have to watch your bullpen. I mean, managing a bullpen is probably in many instances harder than managing a starting rotation, because, you know, you don't know when these guys are going to pitch, when you're going to need them. You can't really, you know with the starter he's going to go out there every fifth day. Well, with the reliever, you don't know that, and then you put yourself in a situation where you use a guy 2 or 3 days in a row, he's not available, and, you know, so on and so forth. And, you know, so it's tough to manage a bullpen. And whenever you have an opportunity, Al, I think, to not use your bullpen, which is what Justin Verlander gives you pretty much every start, he gives you an opportunity to at least not use your bullpen very much, then it makes managing your bullpen a lot easier, because you pretty much know, going into that evening's game, who you'll need from the bullpen. Because you know you're probably going to get into the eighth inning, seventh for sure, the seventh, and possibly the eighth, without even needing a bullpen. So that kind of makes it even easier to say for that evening, who am I going to use, and how much am I going to use him, so that I can have that individual ready for the next day when Ricky Purcello takes the mound. So that's kind of where, you know, another aspect of it. But I never really worry about pitch counts, because frankly, I'm not sure there's a big difference. Maybe I'm just ignorant, but I don't know if there's a big difference between throwing 120 pitches and throwing 130. I mean, it's 10. I mean, I don't know that not having him throw those extra 10 pitches, what that really gets you in the long run. I don't know if that really is that, you know, is that really providing some sort of a benefit that you're going to realize later on, or is it just 10 more pitches? And I just kind of think it's 10 more pitches. Mm-hmm. And frankly, against the Yankees team that can score runs in a hurry, and we saw that. And look what they did to Benoit a couple days later. I mean, you know, I don't. Even though that lead seems sizable, you know, against a shaky bullpen, that's not a very comfortable lead against the New York Yankees.
Yeah, as we just mentioned about the bullpen, I don't think there is a safe lead at all with the bullpen at this point. At least not the way the guys they are counting on are pitching right now. But what's your take on this? Starting pitchers should be able to throw 120 pitches as a piece of cake. I think that's a little bit of a pie in the sky statement, just because we saw how gingerly they were treating Deuce Smiley earlier this year, that they weren't allowing him to pitch more than 100 pitches or go 6 innings. But I guess I tend to agree with him and Justin that we're old enough to remember when starting pitchers went, you know, they pitched big innings, always. You know, 200 innings was a light workload. Today, that's standard. That is the considered, you know, kind of like the baseline for a guy who is an innings eater. An innings eater in the 70s is a guy who threw 300 innings, you know. So that, you know, I can see where he's coming from in that. And, you know, it really came to a head when we were talking about, the, you know, starting pitching today, the starting pitching we used to be. I was writing my recap for Bless You Boys last night, and I was doing some research because it happened to be the anniversary of the Tigers Rangers on Saturday night were wearing their throwbacks to 1976. On August 11th, 1976, Mark Fidrich threw a complete game against the Rangers, beat the Rangers. And I looked it up. Mark Fidrich threw 24 complete games in 1976. Justin Verlander, as much as we say he's a workhorse, Justin Verlander has 20 complete games in his career. So, as much as I'd like to think that 120 pitches is a piece of cake, they don't make pitchers to do that anymore. It's pretty much obvious. It's 100 pitches. And you can see that, by the way, Jim Leland handles the majority of his pitching staff. Once they get to 100 pitches, the timer's on. You know, the clock's going. The bullpen's up. And I don't know. Sometimes baseball's changed, and when I see something like that, I don't think it's changed for the better.
No, and you mentioned Fidrich, and he got those 24 complete games. He didn't even start until mid-May.
Exactly.
He still got 24 complete games. And Anika, if you look even further into that season, there was at least, I think, two or three occasions where he pitched 10 or 11 innings. Which is what Lowitz did, too, by the way, back in the day. But, you know, what I think now is a legitimate concern is I think if a pitcher goes above a certain amount of pitches in a given game, I think that he can be less effective in that game. Because I think most pitchers do tire, let's face it, after a certain amount of pitches. What I don't buy into as much is that repeatedly throwing a guy out there for that many pitches during the course of the season somehow tires him over the course of the season, unless you're really, like you're talking like a Smiley or a younger kid who's maybe not pitching much higher than double-A ball, for example, or who just simply hasn't played as many games in a season as the big league players do. That's a legitimate concern. But a guy like Scherzer, who's been around a little bit, a guy like Fisher, who's been around a little bit, you know, even Purcell, who's in his fourth year, I don't know, Al, that pitches pile up. The effects of pitches pile up over the course of a year. Unless you're throwing a guy out there and he's throwing 120 pitches every night, every start, I don't know that I think that I'm more concerned on the manager is my starter losing effectiveness that night because he's pitching too many pitches. Now, I don't know that I'm worried that, oh my gosh, he's pitching so many pitches that by the end of September or middle of September he's going to be all pitched out. I don't know. I don't buy that. I mean, these guys are in a five-man rotation. They get 4 days rest in between, sometimes five if you have an off day or a rain out in there. I don't know that really the effects, the cumulative effects of pitches over the course of the season is what some people would like you to think it is. I think it's more likely that pitchers tire within a given game because their arm gets fatigued, because these 110 pitches in five innings now is different than 110 pitches in 10 innings. Because 110 pitches in five innings, obviously, that indicates that you're pitching under a lot of duress. You're pitching there's a lot of stressful innings in there. 110 pitches spread out over seven innings is a different story. So it's not even now. It's not even just strictly pitch count. It's really how many of those pitches were made in stressful situations. That's really what it is, and that's where I think pitchers tire over the course of within a given game. I don't know that they tire over the course of the season to the point where you've got to monitor every single flip and start, because like the guy's only got he's only got 3,000 pitches in him during the course of the year, over 30 starts, 100 pitches time, you know, per start. I don't buy that. I think a guy can pitch 115 pitches and be just fine five days later. But I think if those 115 pitches were made under duress, then maybe, you know, you do back off on them the next time. But I don't think over the course of the year these pitches pile up like some people would have you believe.
Yeah, I'm with you there. It's all about high stress, high leverage. And you put it recently, it's if you're throwing 110 pitches in 10 innings, I mean, it is a huge difference between doing it in 5 or 6. And we've seen Verlander do both. So you're right. It's a big difference. And hopefully, the type of baseball we were talking about, specifically Fidrich or Brian, that type of baseball is long gone. Nothing we can do about it. Speaking of, nothing we can do about it, and that seems to be the MVP race and who's going to win it. Right now, the runaway is Mike Trout, who really is having a Fred Lynn-like impact rookie season. You know, right now, even though he came up, he didn't start the season with the Angels, I don't think there's any question that the guy is the most impact football player in baseball right now. You know, he's the prototypical 5-2 player. This guy's playing awesome defense. He may not be Austin Jackson, but he's damn close. And his offense is, the guy's stealing bases, hitting for power, hitting for average. Essentially a 5-2 guy. But Miguel Cabrera has kind of just hit his way into the discussion because of, he's really become, he's stepped up his game as he has the last few years in the second half. He's got an OPS well over 1,000 since the break. He's on track for a 40 home run, 130 RBI, probably hit 320, 330. Triple crown numbers. He's in, I believe, top five in every category. And as actually, I think he had the RBI league this past weekend. He was sharing it on and off with Hamilton. So Cabrera's having a monster season. But he's not having, he's not the impact player that Mike Trout is. And not, well, at defense. Is the best way. He's not the impact player defensively that Trout is. Trout being a center fielder, Cabrera being an average third baseman. Of course, though, Jim Leland, as he did last year, started the Miguel Cabrera for MVP, much like he did with Justin Verlander in 2011, by saying that he thinks that Cabrera should win the MVP. What else is he going to say? But at the very least, though, I think it's almost the certain that it's become a two-man race between Trout and Cabrera, and I still find it hilarious that Jim Leland is calling Mike Trout Wonder Boy, but it fits. But if you look at the media, look at the people who are voting, it really looks like it's Mike Trout's award to lose. McCurry is closing, and the numbers are MVP quality with him. But do you think, Greg, do you think it's Trout's to lose, or do you think that it's going to come down to which team makes the playoffs or wins their division?
It's so funny that we're talking about this because we're talking about Mike Trout as if he's playing for a team that's in first place.
Yeah,
and he's playing for a third-place team. He's playing essentially for a third-place. Frankly, Al, he's playing for an underachieving team, a team that a lot of people thought would not only challenge the Texas Rangers for first place, but would win the division. And that was without counting on Mike Trout to have the kind of year that he's having now. I don't think anybody really foresaw as heralded as he was coming in the
big
leagues.
It was a desperation call-up trying to get the team turned around.
Right. I don't think that, right. They fired the hitting coach, Mickey Hatcher. They had all sorts of problems. Albert Pujols got off to a horrible start out there. And things just weren't going their way. And they're still really not all together. I mean, there's languishing third play, I think, 7 games behind. Josh Hamilton, who you didn't mention, who was running away with it seemed like in the first couple months of the season, I think is still a viable candidate. I mean, I know his average is not 300, but he's 32 home runs and almost 100 RBIs already. His team is in first place, by the way. He's a pretty good center fielder as well.
Yeah.
Now Miguel Cabrera, I personally think he's having a year that is definitely worthy of being considered for the MVP. However, he doesn't play that glamour position that Mike Trout does, or Hamilton, which is center field. And so he doesn't have the impact on games defensively that those guys do. Now, and he doesn't have the speed, he doesn't steal bases, and he doesn't do a lot of things that Trout does. But, I don't know that I would rather have Mike Trout than Miguel. I would still rather have Miguel Cabrera up at the plate in a situation where I need, maybe this is just me being a homer, maybe it is, but frankly, I see this guy play every day, Cabrera, and I know what he can do in these situations, but Trout's numbers are what they are. So it just seems to me that I would still rather have Miguel Cabrera at the plate because the guy has got such a phenomenal approach to the plate, and he's so strong, and he's so good at laying off pitches that a lot of pitchers would love to have you swing at, and a lot of big players do swing at. He doesn't get himself out very often. It's I don't know. I still think to me, he's an MVP. I agree with Jamu. It's so hard, of course, to overlook what Mike Trout's done for the Angels. But again, it goes back to the old Andre Dawson question when Dawson won the MVP for a last place team. You know, how can you, I guess theoretically, Al, how can you say that Mike Trout was more valuable to the Angels than Miguel Cabrera is to the Tigers if the Tigers make the playoffs and the Angels don't?
Yeah. Oh, I'm with you there. I just couldn't fathom what this team would look like if they didn't have Cabrera in the middle of the order. And he's such a good hitter. I mean, in Sunday's game, his first at-bat looked awful against Darvish. He just waved at a strike three. It wasn't a very good at-bat. Yet, when you look at the numbers at the end of the day, he adjusted, had two hits, two RBI, and essentially was the Tigers' offense again. And, you know, just another, you know, as one of my recaps I wrote about Cabrera, I said, you know, ho-hum, three hits, two RBI, another, you know, what, you know, another day for Miguel Cabrera. It's almost become, I'm stunned when he doesn't, you know, when he's not on base, he doesn't get a hit. It's like, Cabrera, right, he's having a year that I think would win MVP 95% of the time. It's just that Trout is such a good story, you know, being a rookie player, and you mentioned the glamour position playing center field and playing it so well does make a difference in the eyes of the voters. But I get one thing that I think it may come in Cabrera's favor is that he's come so close to winning an MVP since he's joined the Tigers, and that he's been a top five. He's been in the top five of the MVP voting every year of his Tigers career, narrowly missing. I believe he's finished second once, and he's got a third place in the fifth. So he might get it this year, the voters thinking, well, Trout's a youngster. He's only, you know, he's in his early 20s. He'll have more chances to win the MVP. This could be Cabrera's year. Let's give it to him instead. But I don't know, Greg. I'm with you there. I think Miguel Cabrera is one of the most valuable players in baseball and likely the most valuable player in the Tigers. But I do think it's Trout's to lose just because of the center field thing and in the highlight reel defensive plays. I think he made two more this week. So it's
Wait and see. There's still a long time. There's still a long way to go. I mean, you could see.
Yeah, there's four or five games left. So
you could see. He is a kid. This Trout is still a rookie. Mm-hmm. You might see him kind of fade in this. You know, who knows? Maybe he fades in the last 6 weeks of the season.
Very possible.
Doesn't. His overall. He's having such a year now that even a slump at this point would make his overall numbers still look good, but. Maybe in this close of a race, Al, when you've got, not only two individuals that seem to be in a close race, but their teams are in races to try to make the playoffs, I think what transpires over the next 6 weeks is really going to determine who gets this thing. I mean, if you remember back in 1987 when Alan Trammell lost out to George Bell for the NBC.
I know, I'm still pissed at that, though. I still am.
And, you know, a lot of Tigers fans would tell you that MVP award should have been lost by George Bell in the last 2 weeks of the season, because based on what Bell did, when the games were on the line and when the division was on the line, and what Trammell did in those last 2 weeks, and not to mention the fact that Trammell had, I think, 343 that year or something like that, and his team did edge out the Blue Jays, and largely because George Bell disappeared in the last week or 10 days of the season, and that's where I think that went awry, that voting. I think what you'll see here is in these next 6 weeks, somebody's going to take control of it. I really do. And I think it's going to be largely based on how well their team does, but also keep an eye out for Trout, because, you know, he may, you know, still hit that rookie wall, or he might just, you know, finally, you know, just tire out. And he may not have the final 6 weeks that he's going to need to win the NFL. He's got the rookie of the year clearly sewn up. As far as the MVP, though, that's a whole different thing. You mentioned Fred Lynn. I remember 1975 was the year that Lynn won the MVP and the Rookie of the Year. And one of those games, one of the reasons why is that in Detroit one night, I think he had 10 RBIs and two or three home runs, and the Red Sox won 15-1 or something. But, you know, Fred Lynn was, he played center field.
He did.
And, But his team won the division with the World Series and all that stuff. So it's going to really, I think it's still anybody's race here. And don't forget Josh Hamilton. I mean, he's still, his numbers are still pretty darn good. And don't forget, too, Al, that the Rangers have maintained this lead
mm-hmm.
in the division, even with a lot of their guys having either bad years or slumps. Mike Napoli is not having the year that he had last year. Nelson Cruz has been slumping. Beltre has slumped at times. Murphy's been steady at 300. But really, it's been Hamilton. Even though Hamilton he slumped in June, really, I mean, when all the other players around him were kind of wobbly, he was still keeping his numbers up, even though his average fell a little bit over 300. So, you know, I don't think he's out of the mix. I don't think you can just discount this guy. I mean, he could still come out and have another hot streak in him. And don't forget Adam Dunn. I mean, it's just crazy that sounds. I mean, Adam Dunn.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And Paul Konerko. There's a lot of games, even Pierzynski. These guys are not going to win. I'm just saying that there are a lot of people who might take votes away from the Trouts of the world and even Cabreras of the world and the Hamiltons of the world, because there are a lot of guys out who have had years that have been very impactful to their team success.
And I think you may be onto something with Trout, that I looked up his stats while you were talking about him, and he obviously, his MVP candidacy really took off in July. Yeah, because he had an OPS for the month of 1.25, and he hit .392. But if you look at August, he's only hitting .275. And I believe his OPS is a much more human, like around .850. So, yeah, he is starting to tail off. So you might be onto something there. And that may end up running into Cabrera's advantage. And as you said, someone else could easily sneak in. And another guy you forgot to mention is Robinson Cano, on another very good team with the Yankees, mm-hmm. who plays on middle infield, which is always, you know, better defensive position you play, the better off you're going to end up doing in the MVP award. All right, I know we're running a little long, sorry, so let's talk a little bit about the Olympics before we wrap it up. And the big story, at least in the States this past weekend with the Olympics, was USA men's basketball. They did win the gold, as expected, to beat Spain 107-100. And it was actually a pretty tight game. You know, Spain's led by NBA All-Star Paul Gasol. But this USA men's team was a bit of a team of extremes. They set an Olympic record for the widest margin of victory. They beat Nigeria 156-73. But the next game, and this is all in the preliminary round, they had a very, very, they had a close call. They almost lost to Lithuania. They beat Lithuania 99-94, but they were behind late in that game, about 4 minutes left. And LeBron James literally had put the team on his back and carried him to the win. So, obviously it worked out as expected. The dream team, as they still like to call it, did win the gold. But I think in some ways I was kind of glad to see this team struggle a little bit, Greg, because it made the tournament much more interesting, to say the least, because basketball has advanced a great deal worldwide since the first dream team in 1992. But it's still, because I remember the talk before the Olympics, the players on this team were saying, oh, yeah, we could beat the 1992 Dream Team. Well, I think that kind of got blown out of the water. But do you have any thoughts on the Olympic basketball tournament? I mean, cause I got to say, I did enjoy a lot of this. I mean, just because I find it fun to see guys that I'd normally see playing the NBA playing for their country. And the emotion they're showing is the sort of stuff I rarely see from these guys when you're playing a regular season NBA game.
Well, you know, that's a good point you make. That's exactly what I was going to say, was that it's refreshing to see that kind of effort and excitement put forth in a situation where a cynical person would say, well, you know, these guys don't really care. You know, they're just out there having some fun, and they know they're going to win it anyway, and what do they care? But, no, I agree with you. I think that what we've seen are highly paid professionals playing for their country very seriously, and they've behaved themselves for the most part very well. Their conduct on the court, certainly off the court, is something that the United States can be proud of, and I'm proud of them. But the thing that I disagree though with isn't so much whether or not whether or not they would beat, because, you know, that's the, let's face it, that's like saying, well, could Muhammad Ali have beaten Joe Lewis? We'll never know. It's comparing apples to oranges. Why even go there? I don't know why you even, that's where it takes a little bit of a rough straw. I wish they hadn't gone there with that whole thing. I think that was uncalled for. Because really, you know, who cares? I mean, you know, they're gold medal winners from two different eras. You know, you got 20 years separating the two. Clearly, that's a question that's never going to be answered anyway. You're not going to pit those two teams against each other anyway in reality. Mm-hmm. So why even go there? You know, that's the thing that it kind of, you know, bothered me a little bit, because I just don't know why that was even an issue. I mean, who cares? You know, I didn't hear the 1980 U.S. Olympic hockey team say they could beat the 1960 Olympic hockey team. Mm-hmm. I mean, who cares? I mean, it's just... You know, that's maybe a question you expect bloggers like us to ask, or, mm-hmm. or the media, but the players themselves should have stayed, you know, should stay above that kind of stuff, because ultimately they're both gold medal winning teams, and that should be good enough.
Yeah, I'm with you there. And and you're right. All it does is bring undue scrutiny, and then when they have a nail biter like they did against Lithuania, all that means is that people start pointing fingers, and you know,
right.
There's no reason for that. They did, and I think you called it. They represented the country very, very well. And I have, and for a bunch of multi-millionaire corporations, you know, you couldn't be prouder of them. You're right. All right. USA won the medal count, 104 medals. China was second with 87, Russia 82, Great Britain with a very surprising 65. But I find it funny, though, you know, they still track the medal counts, even though things have changed from when we were growing up, when it really was us versus them. It was democracy versus communism.
Right.
It was
right.
USA versus the Russians and the East Germans.
Right.
And, you know, as much fun as it is watching Olympics, I always get a little melancholy when the Olympics come to an end, because I always think it's great. I can wake up in the morning, turn on a TV, and there's sports on like five, you know, live sports on like five different channels. But, you know, so I'm kind of bummed this ending, but I do just think that there's a different vibe to it now compared to where it really, at times it really felt like it was life and death back in the 60s and 70s when we were kids.
Yeah.
Now I'm not sure. I life and death sure isn't the right term to put it now. I think it's there's definitely something about it that I guess it's. It feels more lightweight. Maybe that's the best way to put it. But then again, maybe I should, as a kid, maybe it's more the kid me, Greg, that just thought, you know, so much about this, it was more of a big deal than it really was with this life and death stuff. But it really did seem to me, watching guys like Bruce Jenner or
Sugar Ray Leonard,
yeah, going back to this Cold War type stuff, you know, back, especially in the 70s, it was huge. It's different. It's and I'm not sure if it's changed for the better. Even though obviously for the world it's changed better, but it's definitely affected the competition of the
world. You know, you're right. But you know, obviously it was two different times. Obviously, the Cold War played a huge part. But don't forget there were, you know, unfortunately the Olympics were used as kind of an extension of political. It became a political football. In 1980, the United States, the Russians, I believe.
We boycotted
80,
and they boycotted 84.
Right. We boycotted 80, they boycotted 84, okay. So there you had, you know, two straight Olympics where we didn't compete against the Russians at all in summer. It was just kind of, you know, you're right, that there was because of the world situation, because you had the Berlin Wall, because you had East Germany and West Germany, because you had the Soviet Union, because you had that going on in the background, and then you throw in things like Munich, the horrible thing that happened there, and the tragedy, the terrorism that happened there, which people would like to associate with, put that in the category of the guys wearing the black hats, along with the Soviets, and everybody was the bad guys, and these terrorists were part of that. You know, and then you've got the 72 basketball debacle with the United States and Russia. That whole thing where the United States were totally ripped off of their gold medal. You know, and then you had that vote that took place after that game, and all the communism countries voted with each other and voted to uphold the victory, and the United States didn't even bother to show up for the silver medal award, and you know that kind of stuff doesn't happen. Thank God. So that's another reason I think, Al, where you and I had that. You know, you, I mean, you, you, a, he wanted to beat those guys real bad. And then there was also, you know, they were playing each other hockey. Soviets would come here and play NHL teams. With you. You had the Summit Series in 1972. You had the 76 thing with the Flyers and the Russians walking off the ice. And there were a lot of things that happened that kind of fueled that. That kind of fed into that. And right now, things are, better in a way around the world. Certainly, communism is not where it used to be. So that's, I think, all well and good. But I think ultimately, it was. You're right. The importance of it, or the gravity, maybe is a better word, of it was, I think, richer than it is now.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to put it. The gravitas, the gravity of it has changed. And I think that's a very good word. That's a perfect word to use. All right, one more thing before we wrap it up. Usain Bolt channeled his inner Ricky Henderson after he won the 100, 200, and 4x100 in dominant fashion. I mean, literally, in the 4x100 relay, I think he was just blowing kisses to the crowd as he was blowing away the rest of the field. And after the fact, he said, "I'm now a living legend." You know, much like how Ricky Henderson, after he broke the all-time steals record, said, "I'm the best ever." And and then, kind of twisting a knife into the American fan base, he dissed America's greatest sprinter, Carl Lewis, by saying he had no respect for Carl Lewis because Lewis had thrown some suspicion out there that Bolt was juicing, specifically because his times, especially in the previous Olympics, improved by about a second, which is almost an eternity when you're talking 100 meters. But do you like seeing this kind of hubris in an athlete, or do you prefer at least a little bit of humility?
Well, I think that for something like this, where it's not a team sport, that's not in the public eye every year, it doesn't bother me as much. He can say whatever he wants. I mean, who cares? I mean, we know he's the fastest guy. I mean, he's not really saying anything that we don't already know. I remember when you talked about Ricky Henderson, when he held up the base and, he said, "I'm the greatest of all time," whatever he said. And that to me, that's off-putting when Ricky Henderson does it. A guy like Usain Bolt, how often are we going to hear about him anyway?
Mm-hmm.
He's in the Olympics now. That's over with. We know he's the fastest guy. The only thing he's really doing for himself now is just setting himself up for some sort of if he gets upset in a future world competition event going forward. I mean, obviously he's the guy everybody wants to be. He's the one everybody's shooting for. He's the guy who is the standard. Let's face it. I mean, he's the fastest human being in the world. So, I mean, he's not saying anything that's really arguable. I mean, you can't really call him out because he's right.
Mm-hmm.
It just all comes down to, like you said, would you rather, is that too much hubris? Maybe, but frankly, I don't care because he's just going to fade away.
Yeah.
How often is track and field in the public eye? Anyway, a guy like Henderson, that was different because baseball is an every day kind of a thing and it's an every year kind of a thing. Bolt, whatever. He can say whatever he wants. It doesn't really bother me. I mean, he's not, he's the fastest guy. Good for him. And he can have his moment in the sun, but guess what? Next week, who's going to be thinking about Usain Bolt?
No, the Europeans probably, but here in this big market in the United States, that you're right. Track is a track and field, or the vast majority of the sports seems like is and every four, we only care about them every 4 years. Even though some of the sports are really damn entertaining. But yeah, I'm with you. It's nice. It's great that he back it up. But you're right. It comes before a fall. And I'm sure if he does come back for another Olympics, who knows with the sprinters, that I doubt that this is the epoch. It's all downhill from here for a guy like Bolt. There's just no way, considering his sport, that he's going to be able to stay at the top for very long. It just doesn't happen. And I will add this, though. Say what you will about Carl Lewis. I still think it's more impressive doing what he did because Lewis was not only a great sprinter. Lewis was the best in the world at the long jump, too. And I think that says volumes about his athletic.
And he was a hurdler. He also did the hurdles.
Bingo. If you go out and talk all around track athletes, yes, say what you will about, say what Bolt says about himself, I still think it's Carl Lewis, and it's not even close. All right, Greg, I think it's time for the jerk of the week so we can call it a night. So I think, I know you let off last week, so I will lead off this week. So God, where should I go with the Jerk of the Week this week? There's all kinds of stuff I could go with, but, you know, it's... I gotta... You know, I want to go for the low-hanging fruit, and, but, you know, I was tempted to go with Brian Villarreal just because he is another pitcher who didn't tell the team he was hurting.
So, right, like Schlereth. Yeah.
You know, just like Schlereth, you know, there's been numerous Tigers that have gone through this. But, in the, I'm sorry, I got to go with Bo. I really do. Just, you know, as much as though he, no, he deserves the accolades, and he dominated in his events, I just find it a guy that acts like him annoying. It's, you know, the look at me, look, point all the attention at me. The show is all about me. Me, me, me. And that's essentially what Bolt is. You know, and you're right, yeah, the sport he is in kind of, you know, kind of goes for these divas. The sprinters are kind of a diva type. But he is like an NFL wide receiver, and then you multiply it by 10. I mean, he is that, you know, the hubris of this guy is off the charts. And to say the things he did without really, you know, he doesn't win the 4x100 or without the three other guys on the team, for Christ's sake. It's not all about him. So, I'm sorry, Greg. I got to give it to Bolt just because he is such an annoying asshole. So, my Jerk of the Week is Usain Bolt for being a jerk.
Well, you know what? I would probably be with you if he represented the United States.
Yeah.
If he was an American, I probably would be with you there because I wouldn't want an American acting like that. But I can definitely see where you're coming from. I definitely can see where you're coming from. My Jerk of the Week, Al, is NHL commissioner, our favorite commissioner, Gary Bettman, for you know, drawing the line in the sand. He's basically said that September 15th is going to be the deadline. If there's not a new CBA by that point, the owners are prepared to engage in a lockout, much as they did back in 2005 or 2004. And the reason I'm giving the Jerk of the Week to Gary Bettman is that, first of all, I don't think that the offer that has been made to the players is anywhere near fair. It's a joke. And I just think that he is... I guess my question to Gary Bettman would be, have you learned anything, Gary? You've been, you know, I don't know what he's learned, Al, in the years that he's been commissioner. I can't even remember how many years it's been now of the NHL. I don't know if he's learned anything. And I get the feeling that he just doesn't have any sort of a real idea, or he's in denial about where his league is in terms of public popularity in this country. And I think that he has inflated it in his head, and I think he's going down a very dangerous path by kind of, it seems like he wants a lockout. And I don't know, apparently, I just go back out to those signs that were painted on the ice when the NHL came back in 2005 that said, thank you, fans, we're back, thank you for coming back with us. And I just think, no, this kind of makes us all sound like it was a bunch of baloney. All that stuff was baloney. The whole thing about the fans was baloney, because here we are again, going down the same path again. It seems like he's almost, you know, gleeful to go down this path, and I don't understand it. I don't know why the NHL is asking for all these concessions from the players right off the bat. It's just absolutely ridiculous. So my Jerk of the Week is NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman. That's pretty much it for the teachers. I want to thank Mike Sadi, of course, for his analysis, as always, of the Lions. We appreciate that. Adam Biggers will be back with us next week, the third Monday of the month, talking about whatever Adam wants to talk about. Adam Rantz, and then we'll have another guest segment for you 2 weeks from tonight, August 27th. I think that we typically take Labor Day off, so we won't be with you on September the 3rd, but we'll be back. Well, not only pre-taping the May, so keep your eye on Twitter and Facebook and our blog about that. By the way, I'm Greg Eno, so read me every day of the week if you go to GregEno.com. Follow me on Twitter, @GregEno, or Twitter.com/GregEno. Follow the Knee-Jerks on Twitter, TheKneeJerks.info, or @TheKneeJerks. And our Facebook fan page is Facebook.com/TheKneeJerks, and our blog, TheKneeJerks.us, is a shortcut to that. And I want to thank my lovely wife, Sharon, and thank you, Big Al, making money in the Sylvester.
Thank you as well, Greg, for making the time to do the podcast. I know you're usually crunched for it, As always, you can find me at WaynePonce.com, BlessYouBoys.com. Look for the Bless Your Boys podcast, usually at the end of every week. You can find it at all the usual places, including iTunes, Zoom Marketplace, and on Bless Your Boys. I do need to make one quick announcement. I'm going to change my Jerk of the Week to the British Olympic Committee for reuniting the Spice Girls. So, as they're on my TV right now. So.
Oh, boy.
Okay. But, with that, we will see you at the same time next week. So. Oh, and of course, find me on Twitter. Just use the shortcut, bigal.us. We'll see you next week at this time. This is Al Beaton saying good night, good luck, and aloha.
Ciao, Italy, everybody. We'll talk to you next week. Good
night. And we're done.
All right. That should be a minimal amount of editing for you, I'd imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. What they'll probably have to do is plug on the, cut off the beginning and ends, like, and add the music at the beginning and throw in the...
Right.
Throw in the birthday stuff, and that's it. The BP skate. Take me about 15 minutes. So.
Perfect.
Guys, this is working out great.
Good enough, my friend. Well, we will be talking to you next week.
All right, stay out of trouble.
Okay, buddy. Take care.
You see you later.
Bye.